Welcome to Three Cops Talk. On this podcast, three active duty police officers discuss behind-the-scenes stories and real-life accounts of what it's like to be a cop. Every episode, you'll get an inside look at the challenges and dangers they face on a daily basis, as well as the triumphs and inspirational moments that make it all worth it. If you want to understand more about the men and women who put their lives on the line for us every day, then this is the show for you. And now your hosts, Chris, Scott, and Sean.
Today we're joined by a retired 20-year veteran of the Albuquerque, New Mexico Police Department, Daniel Carr. He's an attorney and the founder of Police Law News, which is a social media platform that discusses the most pressing issues facing the policing profession. So please check it out.
The views and opinions expressed in this episode belong solely to the hosts and do not represent the views of any professional organization. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
I was setting the show up here. This guy comes into the waiting room with us here, and he's sniffling, and I was like, yeah. What's up, man? You all right? It's all good?
Andy Capp's hot fries.
Foiling my first serious attempt at peer support.
Yeah.
That's the English predecessor right. to Takis. And I was like, right. There you go.
That's Takis for people in their late 40s.
It doesn't hurt your colon as much.
He was this English cartoon character that was somewhat abusive right. to his wife.
Sure, I'm not laughing about that.
There was like
the cartoons. Yeah.
Image of him sleeping on his sofa, and his old lady was coming in and busting him out, and she had these curlers on. It was maybe appropriate for the time.
Yeah, not but so
apparently,
much.
Apparently, Scott's got more of a history with Andy Capp than
I. Yeah, well,
I was
laughing because the story I was telling is about eating Andy Capp's hot fries at the bowling alley. My mom never wanted me to go to the bowling alley with my dad on bowling night because he wouldn't come home till like 1 a.m. And it was usually after like multiple Manhattans. But that was what I'd get for dinner at the bowling alley. I'd get like $4 worth of quarters to play Spy Hunter or Pole Position video games and 8 packs of Andy Capp's hot fries and a Sprite.
And make it last.
And make it last. Right. Yeah. A blast from the past. Yeah. Right.
Scott's working his way through a 12-step right now, and he's
doing all right.
All right, folks.
Doing all right.
Say a prayer for him. Speaking of saying prayers, obviously, and crying, we definitely had a pretty rough week of our profession when you get right down, particularly in Chicago. We had recently talked about an officer-involved shooting there where we felt that some of the information that was coming out about it was inaccurate. And, you know, we talked about some of the dynamics in that city with politics and stuff like that for people that don't necessarily understand Chicago.
So I was in Chicago this weekend, and I was staying at the Trump.
Of course.
I had some business meetings down there. And
of course,
where else am I going to stay, right? And I drank Trump wine. What do you think of that? But he's the only one that gives you a white chocolate on your pillow and a positive saying, you are braver than you are. I'm like, yeah, I know. All right, thanks. But anyway, so I get done with my business, and I get up early Sunday. I figured, okay, I'm going to get to O'Hare because just in case these, you know, protesters are going to block the roadway. I get up and I figure, okay, I'm going to leave about 9. It's way early for my flight, but I'll get there. Well, downtown is just, it's dead. Like there's nobody around at 9 o'clock in the morning. And as I pull out of the Trump, all I do is I see these squad cars like flying. And I'm like, all right, well, that's not a good sign at all. So I'm figuring, okay, they're heading southbound. I'm going to go west and come back north because there's probably something going on. And you see all this happening. And then I find out that there was an officer shot, you know, earlier that morning, and the guy was, you know, the bad guy was still at large. So it was a scene of almost like just a calm west. And then all of a sudden, you know, here comes the cowboys and the heroes. And I'm like, oh man, you know, and you're thinking at that point, you know, I'm thinking like, it's just like dead silence, and you see it all this. And at the time I didn't know that there was an officer that was shot.
You know, something's going on with all seeing all that.
Something's
right.
going on. And I think the one thing that struck me is, you know, I've been doing a job for almost 25 years. The one thing that did strike me is like, I don't think they care where they're going. They're going to help somebody. And I think in that minute and a half when I saw that, I mean, if that could be captured and just put in a short video going, they have no idea what they're getting into. All they know is that they're going to help somebody. They don't ask the color of the person on the radio. They don't ask them their sexual orientation, their religion. they're not asking a question. They're just going to help whomever needs help.
Just to fill everybody in on what this was Officer Luis Huesca from the Chicago Police Department, who was murdered coming home from his shift on April 21st. After it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and there's some speculation on whether or not it was actually a carjacking or not, but unfortunately he was gunned down coming home and did have his car stolen. There's reports that he also did have his firearm stolen and his CPD badge. Now he was in uniform under his clothing, much like, you know, a lot of officers do when you're maybe going back and forth to court or something like that. So it might have been not initially apparent that he was a police officer, but certainly whoever did this horrible act was fully aware that he was a Chicago police officer. And the sickening thing about this is that there's been stories about it, but there's not really the outrage that should be associated with this. And for those of you that are from this area or follow these kinds of stories and remember from last year, there was an officer by the name of Andres Vasquez Lasso who was fatally shot last year, kind of around this time. And these two were actually friends, both of them on the job about 6 years. And Officer Huesca was just killed the other night, was just a few days short of his 31st birthday. So you're not hearing the outpouring. There's statements from the governor, there's statements from the mayor. Of course, they're saying like nice things. It's a tragedy. But certainly not the outrage of a second Chicago police officer murdered on the way home from their shift in only a year. And one of the stories that I found that is even saying that he was shot up to 20 times because it's suspected that the offender in this might have had one of those switches on their gun, which we've talked about before, basically turns a Glock pistol into a fully automatic.
There was also another officer within less than a year that was gunned down the same way, and that was Ariana Preston, a young, you know, African American police officer, had just achieved her master's degree from Loyola University, the consummate, you know, recruiting grab in our profession that everyone would talk about. That kind of came and went like a ship in the night as well. You know, people were upset, obviously concerned, her family, things like that. The media gave it its cursory coverage, but we have three police officers that come from these communities that have been gunned down, murdered gangland style that we talked about. And there's nowhere near the outrage that we find for career criminals. And I think across the board in those communities, people are growing tired of this. You know, the two communities in question here are the police and these communities that we serve. And we're constantly told we're odds with each other. And it's gotten so bad that we're the only ones dying here. The people that report on it in the media, the politicians that further divide us, their skin isn't in the game. And I think with new media like we're in, with podcasting as well as, you know, the internet, there are voices from within our community that are speaking out as well to say, hey, we need to tell the truth about these things for everyone involved. That's kind of where we're at today. Fanboy moment here, Chris. There's a guy I follow on Substack, and I read his stuff religiously. You reached out to us and said, hey, I got this guy that wants to come on the show, and he was from the Chicago area.
Yeah, I'm back.
And I had just read his last article, and he had a link in there to a TikTok video. And when you sent me that, I was like, oh my God, it was my Taylor Swift moment. You know, I was like, this is it. But it was Daniel Carr.
I'm your number one fan.
We appreciate you being here and getting an opportunity to talk.
Well, thanks, Dan. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. I really do.
Dan, why don't you go ahead and tell folks about yourself?
Well, thank you guys so much for having me on. Again, like I said, my name is Daniel. I'm originally from Chicago. I didn't stick around the Chicagoland area. I had to move 1,300 miles away in order to find a police job because it was so competitive to be a police officer back in 2004. So I ended up getting on with the Albuquerque Police Department. In 20 years there, I was in patrol for about 10 years, DWI, going after drunk drivers for about 5 years. And then my last 4 years, I went inside. I was an investigator for both Internal Affairs Force Division, basically investigating use of force, and then also in compliance. I was the one who presented cases to the force board. You know, one of the things about being a police officer in Albuquerque is the last 10 years of my career, we were under a consent decree from the Department of Justice. And that really shaped a lot of my career kind of at the end, which is a really interesting. I also, while I was working, I went back for a master's degree, and then I finished law school a couple of years ago. And after law school, as you can imagine, being one of the only police officers, and there were a few officers, being one of, you know, two or three police officers in my law school class, obviously I didn't agree with a lot of what people would say. We would get in a lot of really interesting arguments. So after law school ended, I'll be honest, I kind of missed that, having that back and forth, especially with people I didn't agree with. And it was at that point that I started a police law news. I started with TikTok videos. Now I write on Substack over at Police Law Newsletter, and I do social media content there. And you know, really, what my goal is just to, you know, break down some of the most important and interesting issues in policing. And I retired from the Albuquerque Police Department a couple of years ago, and right now I don't have a full time job, so I'm just creating content and writing articles.
Good for us.
Nice. When I saw Daniel on TikTok, it was right after this Reed shooting in Chicago, where I was just up in arms about the whole thing, and they shot him. I don't shoot at the police, and so I. That's kind of like where I discovered. And then I went down the rabbit hole, Daniel, I have to say. It's like, I got to be up at 5 and like 3 o'clock. I'm like, put it down, right. You know? I really thought that that was quite interesting how you're putting it out. And I like to talk about that and how that goes haywire when you have a factual basis for a case. He shoots at the police. He winds up meeting his maker because he shoots at the police. And then it goes just strictly off the rails with fallacies.
Yeah, so here's the reason that I think is because in officer-involved shooting, a controversial case like the Dexter Reed case, I think we can all admit that this shouldn't be a controversial officer-involved shooting. Like, we all know of police shootings where someone maybe was in reach of a gun, or they were almost going to get a gun, or they had a gun holstered. And, you know, maybe we can all agree, like, okay, you know, like, maybe this is a little more controversial. But now we're past all of those lines. Not only was Dexter Reed armed with a gun, pointed a gun, he shot a police officer. So the idea that police officers are going to respond with deadly force seems completely reasonable. And just what you said is that, but somehow this gets into the media, and that isn't the case, where people can't see it as clearly as we see it right now. And the reason why I honestly think that is because there are legitimate questions that people might have about this case. There are honest people who don't hate police officers, but you know, maybe they have questions. Maybe they want to know, hey, how come these police officers stopped him for a seatbelt, but it didn't look like a traffic stop? They went up with him with guns drawn. How come they weren't in full, normal, regular uniforms? How come they were in these cars that look like regular cars? So normal, honest, decent people could have these questions. And the problem is, if people like us don't get out there really quick and really aggressive and start answering those questions are going to be answered by the anti-police activists and the attorneys for the family, who, again, have no reason to. Not only should they not tell the truth, actually, if they tell the truth about what happened in the media, they're actually doing a disservice. And, you know, again, being one of the only cops in law school, this is one of the things that police officers hate about lawyers. Police officers have to be honest to a fault, and attorneys literally aren't allowed to be honest.
Right. And then you see that, and it's like they lie, and then it's almost like an extortion business. Like, seriously, I mean, they just get out there with a bunch of lies, and then you have this national press with the mom, you know, oh, he took a ride in his new car. Obviously, the seat belts didn't work, and then they killed my boy, and they took my boy. No, that's not what happened. But then you have this officer who is, whether he was targeted or whether he was an attempt carjacking, and then they realized he was a policeman, and they had to execute him because they didn't want any witnesses, and they shot him multiple times. Okay, more than once, and they shot him multiple times, but yet, there's no press conference on this, when all this guy did was probably work his 8 or 10 hour shift, save lives, took dope and guns off the street, was on his way home, 2 days away from his birthday, probably looking towards his birthday, and he gets killed. Multiple gunshots. And there's nothing on that. And it's so clear cut that you have a case that they're all making up, and now you have a factual case of a murder, And it's nothing.
If we can, Daniel, dive in on this, some of this stuff a little bit for the dissenters here, the people that may not agree with us. The people said to me, 96 times. Why did they have to shoot at him 96 times?
So the 96 shots, that's something, I mean, in every single article that you see about this case, you're going to see 96 shots. That's going to be highlighted. What you're not going to see is that he first shot at a police officer. So that is just a question that a lot of people are going to have. Hey, it's point blank range. It's really close. Why do police officers have to shoot him 96 times? And if you get into a conversation with people and that's the first thing that you start to answer, it's not going to come out right. So what I always try to like to do when I have an honest conversation is try to peel it back at least a little bit. And I try to do a little bit of education. And I explain that, listen, that yes, the number of shots, that matters, because use of force from police officers does have to be objectively reasonable. But actually the better question, what I'm more concerned about, is the initial reason that the police officers utilize deadly force. If we can all agree that there was a deadly force that was present and we're going to justify that first shot, then it's much easier to justify not only when you're having discussions with people, but also in reality on the street, that if we can agree there was a deadly threat to police officers, then it's much easier to get people on board with, okay, well, he shot at police officers 11 times. So we know that he has the capability and he actually has, you know, tried to kill a police officer. So it's reasonable that the police officers who were there on scene would want to absolutely make sure. And then, you know, I try not to get into the weeds with people. I was actually having a conversation with someone yesterday who's going to have me on a podcast soon. And, you know, she asked me, and she's pro-police, and she asked me the same question. And I try to not go down this force science rabbit hole with anyone. But, you know, sometimes explaining, you know, how the human body works under stress, sometimes that's important, because you have to remember that even if at the exact moment that Dexter Reed was no longer a threat, even if the police officer saw it at that exact moment that it shows on the body camera where there is no objective threat, it still takes the human body, you know, a second and a half to 2 seconds to realize and to basically put that into action. Well, since we all know police officers can shoot anywhere from 4 to 5 times a second, right there you could have 30 shots. And that wouldn't be unreasonable. And, you know, when you're a force investigator or looking at this stuff, that kind of stuff is important, because again, police officers aren't robots. And, you know, when you put humans in unbelievably stressful situations, this is just how the human body reacts a lot of time to this kind of stuff. But again, the more important question is, was there a deadly threat? And if you can get people on board with admitting that there was a deadly threat, it's much easier to say, okay, this is why there's 96 shots, because there were 4 of them. And that's usually the conversation that I try to have with people.
And I feel like they were almost trying to cover the facts of what he did, what his actions were, and just keep driving this 96 shots, 96 shots. Nobody wanted to hear the part about he fired at the officer 11 times. It was just the 96. And not until you dug a little deeper and read a few more articles, and like we talked about, it made it sound like these news outlets were saying that he was murdered on a street corner by these police officers, when in reality, he had fired at them first 11 times. And to your point, it makes it easier then to have a discussion about the amount of force that was used by them in return, especially off the officer that was shot.
If you've never been in that circumstance, you have no idea what it's like. You have no idea, other than human survival takes over and you're doing the best you can with those circumstances. And everybody involved, that good guy, bad guy, whatever you want to say, is probably experiencing some of the same things, because you can't possibly recreate that.
Absolutely. And it's just so dishonest to have no experience in this at all and to watch a body camera video and be like, okay, that's the exact point. Dexter Reed, he's no longer a threat right there. And to assume that the police officers on scene, who obviously aren't looking exactly where the body camera is going to recognize that at the exact same time. But that's what they want to do. And it's extremely dishonest.
Daniel, what's your thoughts about like how the COPPA, you know, their independent review board was coming out and making all these comments and kind of making assumptions before they really had all the facts?
Yeah, I think that what COPPA was trying to do, it seemed like what they were trying to do is they were trying to find anything possible to make the police officers look bad. It was like, okay, Dexter Reed, he fired at at police officers. That should be the end of a lot of it. But instead, Koppel was like, yeah, but they maybe shouldn't have stopped him in the first place. And, you know, maybe there's some systematic racism because, you know, why are police officers stopping people for seatbelts when they're not really interested in seatbelts? And there's a pretextual stop. Like, none of that conversation should even be happening. Like, especially right after this incident occurs, it's like there was they would consider a bad fact, something that makes the police officers look good and it makes Dexter look bad. And their first response is, well, the cops shouldn't have stopped him in the first place. And it's ridiculous.
He shot at the police. The police return fire because you are preserving your life and the life of others. He was just shooting out the window and it's all, well, we're going to march, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And then, you know, then all of a sudden, I don't know if you guys noticed this over the last few days, crickets. Not a word.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a tone-deaf time to be doing that on the heels of this happening to this officer. You know, I mean, like, gunned down in his own neighborhood. Again, the third one in about a year's time that this is happening.
Question that I have kind of been on the outside. So here in Albuquerque, we have take-home cars. So, you know, when I leave the substation, I don't go to the substation to change. Like, I drive home. Like, my police car has been in my driveway for 20 years. Yep. But that's not the case with Chicago police. So, you know, I guess my question is kind of like you said earlier, did this offender, did he know that this was a Chicago police officer, or did he not?
Right. And then here's my question. Let's say this happens all the time, and it happens. The carjacking is probably one of the highest crimes right now, and people are getting shot and people are getting killed. Why is that not on national news? Why are not people marching about that? Why are people not getting frustrated because they're 3,000 policemen short? I really don't understand. And I just think that, you know, to me, it's just a bunch of lies. You know, they want to riot, to tear stuff up and just extort people. That's what it appears to me, instead of facts.
So Daniel, when you did some internal affairs related stuff, right? Related to use of force when you were in Albuquerque. So what were there things in your area of the country that you encountered, or problems like this, or media, or all of the above, or all of the above that you would deal with when you had maybe some kind of significant incident or an officer involved shooting?
Absolutely. You know, that's a really good question. Yeah. So back in 2014, the Department of Justice did an investigation of the Albuquerque Police Department, and they found that the Albuquerque Police Department had a pattern and practice of excessive force and violating people's rights. So in 2014, the Department of Justice came in, and actually they're still there now. So the Department of Justice, under a consent decree, the city of Albuquerque has been for the last 10 years. So the media around that has been pretty bad. Also, we did have two different police officers who were charged for an officer-involved shooting that also happened around that time in 2014. It was a hung jury, thankfully, so the police officers weren't charged. But our city, I mean, it's you know, we have about 500,000 people here, and there's about 1,000 officers. So it's on a smaller scale than Chicago police are. But I mean, we really deal with the same issues. And, you know, there's been so many officer involved shootings where the city pays out, you know, millions of dollars. But, you know, when it comes to it, you know, there's nothing illegal about that shooting. And, you know, where I was and you know, they in part of this DOJ consent decree, you know, what I always say is like, it wasn't all bad, like how we got there, like the process of the DOJ consent decree and how much it costs. That was terrible. But like some of the policies and some of the stuff, it hasn't all been terrible. So one of the things that it did, it basically separated internal affairs into two different places. So it basically had internal affairs professional division, which is basically like, you know, if you're sending pictures or something to someone that you're not supposed to be, normal internal affairs, and then force division, which just investigates officer involved, really any kind of use of force. Yeah. And that's what I was able to do.
Like Scott and I did the one episode on, you know, best places to work according to this study. And they said that, you know, New Mexico was not one of the better ones for job protections and things along those lines, and the difficulty that they have in solving homicides out there. Can you give us a little take on that?
So our homicide solve rate used to be around 50 or 60%. So I'm just talking about the Albuquerque Police Department, not around the state. I was with just one agency my whole career. So we were like 50, 60% solve rate, which wasn't great. And the last 3 years, we're at like a 98% solve rate. So we've done a lot better in Albuquerque. But what I can say about the homicide rate is that, you know, you hear this, you know, about that, you know, when the Department of Justice comes in, that, you know, cities actually get more violent. But, you know, maybe you don't know if that's true or not. Well, I can tell you how true that is. So in 2014, right when they said that we had a excessive force and we were violating people's rights, the city of Albuquerque had 35 murders. Last year, we had 110. So far this year, we're already at 40. So 10 years of a consent decree. I mean, what it does, it demoralizes police and it diverts resources to, like, really, you know, different jobs like me. Like, I was in, like, they double tripled how many people were in internal affairs and things like that. And it's hard to keep cops on the street. So, yes, you have this DOJ consent decree, you know, supposedly because the police officers are in control. But, you know, one of the predictable results is that the homicide rate almost quadruples.
Yeah. And they seem to be never ending. We've talked about that on here before. We've discussed this, consent decrees, and 10 years you've been under this. And it's like, where are the benchmarks of whether or not this is helping? And you right there, you talk about the violent crime, but it's good to know that there are some good things that can come of it. Hey, we need to change some policies. Yes. We had some problems. We had some issues. And we talked about Phoenix, how Phoenix, some of the folks, even the residents and whatnot, said, no, we don't think that we need this. It's so expensive. And even the Phoenix Police Department came out and said, you know, we're making improvements. Give us an opportunity to improve. So it's good to hear that Albuquerque has made those improvements. But 10 years later, I can only imagine the cost. And it's like, do they have measurable results to report back and say, oh, yep, we're on a better track? How could somebody look at that and think about probably the millions and millions and millions of dollars that they've spent and say, oh, 10 years later, we've got, you know, three or four times the homicides? I mean, I shake my head at that.
Right. Return on investment there. You know what I mean? You thought Social Security was a scam, a Ponzi scheme. Are you kidding me?
And they do actually have benchmarks for these consent decrees. Actually, my last couple of years, they had me be the one to teach it to new officers, what those were. So there are benchmarks. I think we're at like 94% right now or something. So I think we're close. My guess is the DOJ will be out of here in about 2 years. But if that's the case, it would have been 12 years.
Oh, my God.
Do they provide updates on that? Do they say, you know, oh, you're almost there? It's like,
oh, you're almost there, but here's the next invoice.
Exactly.
Right. Almost.
Missed it maybe by that much. Four.
They're booking the big room at the Holiday Inn Albuquerque, so when they have the celebration, Daniel's going to come back and talk. Going to do a TikTok from there, I hope.
Oh, thanks for coming on the show, Daniel. I really appreciate it. Keep making that content, because seriously, I think the content that you put out is so important, because it's just there's so many fallacies out there. And I think people start going down the rabbit hole on the wrong thing and they don't look at the other side, which is actually the truth. And that's what I really, really appreciate you doing, putting the truth out there. So tell our one fan where they could follow you on TikTok.
I already know that.
You guys can follow me pretty much everywhere over at Police Law News. And thank you guys so much for having me on.
Yeah, it was great.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure.
Good stuff, man. Appreciate it.
Everybody, seriously, go follow Daniel. You know, subscribe. You know, comment on his stuff. Give him more content. Ask him questions, just like we'd like you to do to us. Because, as we discussed earlier, people get a lot of the wrong information, and we are trying to do what is right for the people and make it a better place by bridging the gap between reality and fallacy between people and the police. So please go to 3copstalk.com and leave a message for us. If you have any questions, any ideas for the show, go to where we get your podcast and leave us a rating, review, subscribe, and tell all your friends. And again, please go follow Daniel. He's great. Thanks, everybody.
I'm going to again close an episode in remembrance of two of our younger brothers that were murdered in the past week. Although we have previously provided you with some details surrounding his death, please join us in properly honoring the memory of Officer Luis Huesca of the Chicago Police Department. Luis served the citizens of Chicago for 6 years and is survived by his mother and his uncle. He was 30 years old, and his killers remain at large. Sadly, another officer was also murdered on April 21st. Deputy Sheriff Tobin Bolter of the Ada County, Idaho Sheriff's Office was shot and killed by a wanted subject during a traffic stop. Despite the help and initial medical aid provided by a private citizen, Tobin later succumbed to his injuries. His suspected killer subsequently died in a gunfight with other police officers that were attempting to apprehend him. Deputy Poulter had 7 years of law enforcement experience, having served only 4 months with the Ada County Sheriff's Office. Prior to that, he was with the Meridian and Pleasant Hill Police Departments in California. He was 27 years old. Please take the time to honor and remember these officers for their service, the memories in their families, friends, police agencies, and their ultimate commitment to our profession. Say a prayer and say their names.